Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Science Questions is made possible by a U.S. Department of Labor grant from the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development and the Utah Department of Workforce Services.
Un, deux, trois.
Science Questions!
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. Tyler Nordgren is an astronomer and associate professor of physics at the University of Redlands in California. In just 1 year, he visited 12 national parks, photographing and studying the stars. About photographing the pristine parks, Tyler writes, "At night, I see our true place in the universe, without the sun to light up the sky and drown out all the sense of the larger cosmos beyond our atmosphere." As a researcher at the U.S. Naval Observatory, he used his experience to help design the Navy prototype optical interferometer, a device that allows astronomers to view the stars with unprecedented resolution. He wrote the book Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks, which focuses on a range of astronomical topics from within many of our nation's national parks. Nearly every page is complete with a stunning photo or informative graph, without resembling a high school textbook. Instead, it is probably more comparable to The Cosmos by Carl Sagan. Also discussed is how for thousands of years, humans who live in national parks have always been astronomers. Nordgren first explains how astronomers are able to tell what planets are made of and what is on them, such as ice or gases.
It all comes from light. And that's the one fun thing about astronomy, is that unlike physicists or chemists or biologists, where you can go into your laboratory and you fiddle around, do an experiment with something you can hold in your hands, astronomers, we're a passive science. We have to let that light come to us. And so you look at the light that you get, and you take that light, and you can pass it through a prism, spread out that white light into all the colors of the rainbow. And if there are certain colors that are not present, we call these absorption features, absorption lines. That tells us that there are certain elements within that thing giving off the light that are present. Every element in the universe that you see on the periodic table, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, every single one of those elements has its own special fingerprint of what wavelengths, what colors of light it will absorb or it will give off. And so if you look somewhere and you see that those specific colors are absent, that tells you that element must be there, absorbing all that color, all that light. And so you can look out at the moons of Jupiter or the stars in the sky or even now planets orbiting those other stars in the sky, and you can begin to tell what elements must be there in their atmospheres or what elements must be there on their surfaces.
What inspired the book, and how did you come up with the idea to tour the nation's national parks and talk about their night skies and the importance of preserving them?
Well, it started really about 5 years ago. I was taking a vacation. Classes had just ended here at my university, and I was up at Yosemite National Park just hiking enjoying the park. And that evening I did what thousands of visitors do every day, and I decided I was going to go see the evening ranger program, and it happened to be an astronomy talk. And so I'm sitting there in this amphitheater, and the park ranger happens to be Ranger Kevin Poe from Bryce Canyon. He was out at Yosemite, and he was talking about what the parks were doing to protect their night skies so that visitors could still see the stars. And I thought, well, that's wonderful. As an astronomer, I think that's great. But then I noticed that the amphitheater around me was just, not only was it packed with people, but they were all just absolutely fascinated by what the ranger was talking about. And every time he had a photograph of a new galaxy or view of the Milky Way, everyone just oohed and awed. And I suddenly realized it was like it was this blinding flash that if I wanted to reach out to the public about what I was doing as an astronomer and what the latest discoveries were and how to have a personal experience with that world above, the place to do it was there in the parks. So that suddenly it all just came together, and I realized that during my upcoming sabbatical, when I had a year off from teaching, that rather than spending it writing a couple of research papers that maybe a dozen other astronomers would read, I could actually spend that year traveling through the national parks, talking with the public, talking with rangers, working on this book, and capturing images of what park visitors could see. And in the end, the book came out of that.
Can you describe really how much of a problem it is, light pollution, and the importance of these parks in preserving the night skies?
Well, when I talk to my students, I'm at the University of Redlands, which is right outside of Los Angeles. We're part of the great L.A. basin. And when I ask my students if they've ever seen the Milky Way, out of a group of 40, maybe two hands will go up. And I'll ask them, well, where'd you see the Milky Way? And they say, a national park, as a family vacation, Grand Canyon or Zion. And I see that every night. I step outside my house, I look up, and on a clear summer's evening, I can count all 12 stars in the sky. So, you know, that is not the view that human beings have had, really, for thousands of years. I mean, for all of human history, this Milky Way, this star-filled sky, thousands of stars, that was everybody's view of the sky every single night. But only in the last 100, 200 years have we started filling the sky up at night with light. Until now, your typical person doesn't even bother to look up at night because there's nothing there to see. Our current estimates are that half the people that are born this year worldwide will never see the Milky Way in their lives.
That sounds tragic.
It is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you think about the national parks. The whole reason for creating the national parks during the last century was that people realized as we were spreading west, as we were looking for resources, building cities, that it was important to save these few representative areas of just natural, pristine beauty so that later generations could have a place to go and rest and relax and get in touch with that primordial wonder of the earth. And yet, here's this night sky, something that we human beings have had ever since we've been human beings, and we've made absolutely no conscious effort to preserve it. And so, through just lack of being aware of it, we've slowly let it disappear until now really the only place you can go in order to see that universe above, the way it was supposed to be seen, is in those few national parks.
And how have these views and these skies shaped landscapes throughout history?
Well, you think about cultures all over the earth. Every culture has some story, some explanation for what that Milky Way is. We have the constellations that have come down to us from some Greek and Middle Eastern mythology, in which we have these morality plays up there in the sky, those heroes and figures that were vain, and so the gods put them up there amongst the stars or set them around to forever wheel around the North Star so they never set, so they can never get rest. We have all these myths and legends that have come to us that occupied people and entertained people throughout history. And now, again, from where I am, I can go out on a summer's evening, and I don't even think I can make out a full constellation anymore from where I am. So we're really missing something that's been an integral part of our culture up until, again, only the last couple hundred years. And because it's happened so slowly, we haven't really noticed it. It's just all slipped away. You notice it when somebody cuts down a tree or paves over a grove, but you don't notice it when the stars just sort of silently slip away into that background glow.
Archaeoastronomy is the study of the knowledge, interpretations, and practices of ancient cultures regarding celestial objects or phenomena. Nordgren provides numerous examples throughout his book of how ancient cultures utilized the sky in their everyday lives.
There's some wonderful examples with the Native Americans in the American Southwest, what used to be called the Anasazi. Today we call them the ancestral Puebloan people. They have structures, great houses, buildings that they've made that appear to have alignments with either the North Pole of the Earth or with the rising sun on the longest day or the shortest day of the year. And one of the things that we know about the Puebloan people today is that the calendar, their calendar for knowing when to plant and harvest, they know these things by paying attention to where the sun rises on the horizon. When the sun rises behind this particular butte, that's the day when you need to plant because the rains are coming. And this is, you know, up until recently when we had watches and wall calendars, if you wanted to know what the date was, you went out and paid attention to where the sun was in the sky. We even have this in cathedrals. Go to Europe, and there are a number of cathedrals that have holes up in the ceiling where a beam of light will come in from the sun at noon, and where that beam of light hits tells you what the calendar date is so that you know when, say, Easter is coming. And so this is something, again, that people have always done. They've always needed to know when the harvest came, when the longest day of the summer was, or when the shortest day of winter. And so after that, the sun would come back and with it would bring the warmth. So this is what archaeo or ethnoastronomy is learning how these cultures made sense of all this.
What do you think we're losing then by losing the sky and the sense of what more we can learn from it and how we interact with it?
We lose our history. We lose any understanding of how our ancestors made sense of the world. And as a result, when we come upon things like, say, Stonehenge or some of these structures in the Southwest or the pyramids, we think, oh, our ancestors couldn't have built this. They must have had help by the aliens. And it's because we have no idea how people could have figured this stuff out, because we don't know, and we don't know it because we don't bother to pay attention to it anymore. We also lose our sense of where we are in the universe. We can't look out, see any other stars out there. We can't see our Milky Way, which is our home galaxy. And so we get the sense of being alone, isolated. We have no idea that we're a part of something vastly larger out there in the universe. And you know, when we lose that, well, we also lose a sense of really how precious and rare we are. If you stop paying attention to the stars and the planets out there, you don't learn or you forget that of the planets here in our solar system, we're the only one that can hold life. And that makes us precious beyond rubies. And if we knew how rare we were, maybe we'd take better care of our planet.
I believe it's in the book you describe really beautifully how we're connected to stars.
Oh, yeah. Everyone sort of thinks that we're connected to stars. I look through how many horoscope sections you can find in a newspaper. So I bet your average person would think that on some level, oh, yes, of course we're connected to the stars. But reality, in reality, that connection is so much more profound. The starlight that we see, if we can see it, that starlight is generated deep within the cores of stars by nuclear fusion. The extreme pressures and temperatures taking individual little hydrogen atoms, fusing them together and making helium. And helium gets fused together to make carbon. Every element you see around you on the Earth was made in the core of a star. The carbon, the oxygen, and the hydrogen, the nitrogen in my body was made in stars. And when those stars finish making those elements, when they finally run out, they blow up, and those elements get strewn throughout space. And when a later day star and its collection of planets form, they form out of those new elements, and life that comes along belong on those planets is made of those elements as well. So everything that you see on this Earth, everything that you touch, you feel, the air you breathe in, the blood pumping in your veins, all of it came from stars. And when we lose sight of the stars, we literally lose sight of where we came from.
Yeah, it's interesting how something so far away and seemingly untouchable is actually all around us and even in us.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you say that tides are an example of planetary bodies affecting one another?
Right.
And you mean ocean tides?
Ocean tides, yes. Anybody who walks along a seashore and you see the tide come in, the tide go out, you have the tide pools there marking the different levels of the ocean. Those tides are caused by the moon. The moon and the Earth exert a gravitational force on one another. And the strength of that force depends upon how far away we are from one another. Well, there are parts of the Earth that are closer to the moon than other parts of the Earth. And so different parts of the Earth experience different gravitational forces, and you wind up with these two bulges as on the Earth of water. Rock isn't that fluid, but water is. And so those different gravitational pulls sort of pull out these two bulges of water. As the Earth turns underneath in 24 hours, you know, on average, any place on Earth will go underneath one of those bulges twice a day. And so that water being pulled away from your seashore, giving you low tide, well, that's because the moon is out there somewhere. And these tidal forces are at work on other planets. There are other planets in the solar system that have moons. And so there are moons of Jupiter that have tidal forces. Some of those tidal forces actually deform the rock of those moons, because Jupiter's huge. Jupiter's like 300 times bigger, more massive than the Earth. So there, the tidal forces are huge. And on one of the moons, Io, that rock is actually deformed. And when rock moves against rock, it generates friction. Friction generates heat. That heat bubbles to the surface. And you have this moon, which becomes the most volcanically active body in the entire solar system. And all that is tides. And you can experience that by walking on the seashore.
We have volcanoes in our solar system.
Yes. The largest volcano in our solar system is on this tiny moon, Io, about the same size as our moon. And it's that volcanic moon of Jupiter. And if you took any square inch on that little moon of Jupiter, the amount of heat coming out of that square inch would be 40 times the average heat coming out of any square inch on the surface of the Earth.
And what is your favorite planet or favorite galaxy, space object?
Oh, I love Mars. I absolutely love Mars. And it's one of the reasons why I love going to Utah. I love the red rock country there in southern Utah and northern Arizona. Because as I'm driving along in my car down some dusty, dirty back road, and the red rock buttes and mesas are all around me, I can almost imagine that I'm walking along the surface of Mars somewhere.
Would you travel to space if you had the opportunity?
Oh, absolutely, in a heartbeat. When I was growing up back in the 70s, my original plan was to be an astronaut. I really wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to walk on the moon. I wanted to go to Mars. And somewhere along the way, astronaut turned into astronomer. It's close, but yeah, I'd still love to be up there.
How can touring these parks and observing and appreciating not only the landscape on Earth, but the landscape in the sky, how can that broaden your scientific knowledge, but also your humanities background?
You take a look at the people that go out to the national parks, and you ask them, why are they there? Standing on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, you get this feeling of just wonder and wow, it's something that just absolutely boggles the mind, but yet also gives you this very spiritual sense of well-being, that here you are someplace just full of majesty and power and natural wonder. How could that be? You wonder, how could that come to be? Where did that come from? And the night sky does exactly the same thing. Every single time, every person I've seen who sees the Milky Way or Saturn for the first time through a telescope just says, wow, and is overcome with a sense of wonder and amazement. And when you can help share with that person where those things came from, what that Milky Way is, a collection of 100 billion stars, of which we're just one star in an outskirt-lying arm. The sense of wonder and spiritual connection to this thing that is larger than us, it at least tells me that the more we close ourselves off from this, the more we diminish ourselves. People think that you look at a sky full of stars, that they ask, well, don't you feel awfully small? Well, on the contrary, it actually makes me feel really wonderful, because I realize that of all those billions of stars out there, of all those hundreds, millions, maybe billions of planets that might be out there around those stars, as far as we know, we here on Earth, we're the only ones who can look up and understand it all. No cloud of gas does that. No inert lump of rock, asteroid, dead planet. We here on Earth, around this sun, we are able to make sense of what we see, and that makes us special, and that makes us rare. And that's why I hope to share that with people.
And what are some of the best parks for viewing night skies?
Bryce Canyon National Park is right there on the edge of Utah's real dark sky country. Natural Bridges National Monument is another spectacular place. Great Basin up in Nevada and Big Bend National Park down in Texas are also spectacularly dark. But also places like Grand Canyon and Yellowstone on the East Coast. Acadia National Park is one of the darkest places on the East Coast. So you don't have to just come out to the West Coast in order to see the Milky Way. You can see it fantastically there in Acadia in Maine.
And what about internationally? Have you traveled or done research internationally on the best spots around the world?
A little bit. You can take a look at satellite imagery of the world taken at night, and you can see that in Europe, for instance, there is almost no place you can go in Europe, with the exception of far northern Scandinavia or down into the Sahara Desert in North Africa. With the exception of those places, there's nowhere you can really go there that's as dark as what we have out here on the west, the western half of the United States. I recently took a group of 16 students to Italy. We were learning about Galileo. We had replicas of his telescopes, and we were going to try to reproduce the observations that he made. And one of the key observations that he made 400 years ago was that the Milky Way was simply lots and lots of very faint stars very, very far away. Nobody knew that before then. Well, there was no place that we were able to go in Italy, none of the places that Galileo had been, where you could see the Milky Way anymore.
What can we do to improve our night skies?
It's easy. That light that blots out the stars overhead, well, that's light, light from our cities, light from our homes, light from our streetlights that shines upwards to bounce around and scatter off of everything that's in our atmosphere. And that light that shines upward is actually light that doesn't really do anything useful. We need lights at night to be safe. And we need that light to be safe on the ground. At least no one I've talked to is afraid of giant mutant bats sweeping down from above and carrying them off. So lighting up the sky doesn't really do anything useful, except just waste light, waste electricity, and waste money. So what we can do is put shades on our lights that makes all the light that used to go upward instead go down. So if you have a shade on your lamp, that comes down below the level of the light bulb so that any light that used to go up instead gets reflected downward. Then you get all the light that you need on the ground. And if you don't need extra light on the ground, then you can put in a lower wattage light bulb. And so you save electricity, you save money, and you save the stars.
And one of the pages in your book, you have a photograph of the, it's in the Grand Canyon, and light from the Andromeda Galaxy shining down into the Grand Canyon, and the light took 2.5 million years to reach us.
Yes.
So that's another interesting point, too, is how long that light is taking to reach us, how old that light is.
Absolutely. You know, when you look down into the Grand Canyon from standing up on the north or the south rim, you see all those layers down there in the Grand Canyon, and each layer down in the Grand Canyon is a layer that's farther back in time. So the Grand Canyon itself reveals our history. It reveals our past. And it's the same way with space. Light takes time to get to us. So the farther away you look in space, the farther back you're looking in time. It's taken that light so much longer to get to us. So that's the other thing. As we drown out the sky with light, we lose all those faint things, and so we lose our view of the past in the universe.
And what kinds of telescopes can you recommend that the average person can buy, or an amateur astronomer?
Well, the first thing I'd recommend is actually not a telescope at all, but maybe just a simple pair of binoculars. Galileo himself, his very first telescope with which he saw the craters on the moon, the moons of Jupiter, and those stars of the Milky Way, it had a magnification of about 20 times. That's about a good pair of binoculars. So if you get yourself a real good pair of binoculars and a tripod to put them on so that you can steady your view when you look up in the sky, you can have as good a view as the universe as Galileo had. And there are a lot of really beautiful things out there, including the Andromeda Galaxy, that are quite stunning through just a simple pair of binoculars.
And can you describe what it would look like through a pair of binoculars?
Oh, the Andromeda Galaxy will look like this faint, fuzzy oval set amidst a field of diamonds spread out on a black velvet cloth. Get yourself someplace really dark, and just the stars themselves are absolutely beautiful. But you take a look at the moon, and the moon reveals itself to be this cratered, mountainous other world. And it was that view that first let Galileo know that the moon and the planets were worlds like the Earth, not just some sort of strange, ethereal, heavenly object.
Blending science and the humanities is a priority for Nordgren, and he does it extraordinarily well in his astronomy education. In conclusion, he explains why it is crucial to always keep science in mind.
You look around today. We live in a world where you have your iPhone. You have instant communication with everyone you know. If you get out to the national park and suddenly don't have cell phone reception and can't check your email, update your Facebook status, or just find out what the weather is by checking your app that you have, you suddenly feel really uncomfortable. It's a change. We are in a completely linked, networked world that we've come to depend upon. All of that technology is science-driven. We could not live in this world without science. And if you don't understand science, then you're at the mercy of those who do, and you are dependent upon them. You are not fully in charge of your life and control of your life. And maybe it's as simple as if you don't understand how a cell phone works, you don't have any idea for why you will and will not have cell phone reception. Maybe it's as simple as that. But on a much more fundamental level, you become illiterate. You are scientifically illiterate in today's world. At that point, you stop being a person who's in control and can drive where the world goes.
That was Tyler Nordgren, author of Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. And that's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. You can visit us online at sqradio.org. Wasatch Elementary third grader Olivia leaves us with this audio postcard from outer space.
My name is Olivia and I am 9. Dear family, you haven't noticed I'm not at home because I'm at the Milky Way. Did you know that the Milky Way includes the Sun, the Earth, and the rest of our solar system? By the way, the Milky Way is a galaxy, a huge group of stars and other objects in space. Love, Olivia. Thank you.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the folk bluegrass album from Rita Hosking and the affecting new album from Vance Gilbert. I'll also play songs from new releases by Greg Engel, Kate Campbell, and Jenny Bieneman, to name just a few. Tune in and listen this Saturday at 8 p.m. to Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions Live. This is Sherry Quinn. Joining us in the studio today is astronomer Phil Plate. He is the author of the book Death from the Skies, The Science Behind the End of the World, and Discover Magazine's Bad Astronomy blog. He is the featured USU Science Unwrapped speaker tonight at 7. Welcome to the program, Dr. Plate.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great. First of all, could you tell us a little bit about your background, why you chose astronomy, and at what age did that spark your interest?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, and it always makes me laugh because it's not something that came later in life. I was five, and my parents bought a cheap, junky department store telescope, and my father set that up in the driveway and pointed it at Saturn. And even through that, you can see Saturn's rings, and it's a planet. It's gorgeous. And I was hooked. I saw that and was like, oh, yeah, 5 years old. Yeah, I'm going to do this the rest of my life. But it turned out to be true. And you know, it was close. There were dinosaurs involved. So now I'm doing both, since dinosaurs were wiped out by astronomy. It's easy enough to talk about both of them now, but it's clearly been a lifelong passion for me.
Okay. And what about your experience with NASA and satellites?
Well, right out of grad school, I was hired by a company to work on NASA's COBE satellite, which was built to look at basically the remnant fireball of the Big Bang. It was designed to try to figure out where we all came from. You answer one of these really big questions. And I had been using Hubble for my research up to then. And after the COBE thing went away, I started working on Hubble again. So I've been not a NASA employee, but I've been affiliated with NASA for a long time and using satellite technology to do space astronomy. And it's been fantastic. It's just so amazing to think that we build and launch these things and then get these incredible, you know, the data, the information we get is fantastic, but also just the artistic beauty of these images is profound. So it's always been an amazing experience.
How difficult is it and how important is it for us to have these satellites in outer space and to study it and these planets? And
how difficult it is? It's rocket science. You know, there's a reason we say that. And it's funny, a lot of rocket scientists say, well, this isn't that hard. It's actually just one equation to launch a rocket into space. But yeah, but it's hard to build these things. And Hubble was originally proposed in, I think, the 1960s or 70s, and it wasn't built until the 80s, and it didn't launch until 1990. It takes years and years and years to build these things. So it's really, really hard, but it's really, really important. It may not affect people's daily lives, and I can argue either way. It's not like you wake up and you make your coffee and think, wow, I wonder if the aurora on Saturn is being caused by magnetic coupling, blah, blah, blah. It's not like that. On the other hand, if you get up in the morning and you flip on your computer and you see this gorgeous picture of a couple of moons orbiting Saturn, and that adds a little bit of beauty, a little bit of depth to your life, that's good. But it's also, you know, we're humans. We ask these big questions, and now we're getting to a point where we can answer them. We didn't know if there were any planets orbiting other stars when I was a kid. We didn't know if there were any planets orbiting other stars when I was in grad school. And now, you know, we know of dozens, hundreds, and there are thousands more that may be out there. It's amazing that we can say, are we alone? Which we've been able to do for thousands of years. But now, we have a good shot at answering questions like that.
How quickly does the pace of this technology and the knowledge happen in this field? Like you said, since you're a child and even in graduate school, we've learned so much.
In some fields, it's like your normal experience in technology, where when you buy a phone and bring it home, it's already obsolete. And, and that happens. You can spend a career in grad school learning a specific subject, get a job, and then by the time you get the job, you realize the entire thing has been revolutionized by a single mission. And that's, for example, if you want to study planets around other stars, you better be at the top of your game, because today is going to be a lot different than yesterday. Things change very rapidly. On the other hand, there are some fields where progress is very slow. It just takes a long time. The observations are difficult, and, you know, it's based on stuff that we've understood for a long time. It just depends on what you pick. But a lot of the exciting stuff right now is cutting edge. I guess that's true for any science, for anything in life. You know, the cutting edge stuff is where it's exciting. And it's changing on a day-by-day basis.
And how has the universe changed for you in the course of your research?
Well, it's bigger now, but it's... See, that's an astronomy joke, because it's expanding. It's bigger yesterday than it was yesterday. It's actually changed a lot. I studied stars that explode. I guess that was my first taste of death and destruction in the sky. And the one I happened to study was an unusual example of it. And we were trying to figure it out, because it was so odd. We were hoping that it would have the key to more normal things. You kind of study some of the odd things to see what the exceptions can help you understand the things that normally happen. And since then, we found other stars that have exploded like that, other things that look like that. And we've seen thousands of these things now. And so with bigger telescopes and more time, you just get a better sample. And so it's amazing to me that the stuff that I was doing that was cutting edge, and I guess, again, this is true for everything, stuff that was cutting edge 20 years ago is just old hat now. It's like, oh, yeah, the stuff that Plate did, yeah, big deal. Now we're doing this, which is really exciting. And I think keep that feeling while you can, because in 10 years, you're going to be in the same position.
What does an exploding star look like, and why is it important that – why would a star explode?
What it looks like is maybe not as exciting as you would hope. It just looks like a star because they're really far away. And so you look at it through a telescope. What happens is a star like the sun, for example, cannot explode. I wrote about this in my book, and I had to be very careful about this. People say, oh, our sun's going to explode. No, not really. It's going to sort of peter off. It's just going to fizzle out. But big stars, and there are different kinds of ways stars explode, but the kind most people think are these massive, hot, violent stars. And at the end of their lives, their cores collapse and form black holes, which is a whole other thing that everybody loves to talk about, black holes. But the rest of it explodes outwards, and it creates a tremendous amount of energy. And the cool thing about them is that they're so bright, you can see them clear across the universe. So if you want to study supernovae, when one goes off, yeah, pretty good odds you're going to be able to see it. The reason they're important is, first of all, our lives depend on stars. It depends on our stars, so it's good to understand what they do because they directly affect us. But in this case, this is another one of those big questions. When you ask, where do we come from? Why am I here? Why am I made of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen, and I have iron in my blood and phosphorus in my DNA? Where did that come from? How did it get here? And the answer is stars. When the universe formed, it was just hydrogen and helium. It was very, very simple. And stars took those basic elements and created more and more complex things. It created all of the carbon, all the oxygen, and literally the iron in your blood and the calcium in your bones, the phosphorus in your DNA, and the gold in your jewelry. These were all created inside stars and were scattered throughout the universe as these stars died, whether they blew up or just faded away one way or another. They deposit these elements into the universe, where they can form more stars, planets, and eventually us. So astronomy is directly answering these questions of where do we come from.
Right, and you have this challenge of explaining basic astronomy, which is very technical. And can you talk about the challenges of trying to communicate the difficulty of astronomy to the general public?
Most of it is due to existing misconceptions that people have about astronomy. Astronomy can be very technical. Of course it can. It involves very complex physics and math, but it doesn't have to. Astronomy can be as simple as walking outside and looking up. You know, if you have the right kind of equipment, you can see sunspots on the sun very easily. You can go out at night right now in the western sky, and you can see Venus and the moon is nearby. Mars and Saturn are up. If you have binoculars, you can see Saturn's rings. It is that simple. The complexity you can add to that is your own choice, but astronomy is beautiful and gorgeous and satisfying, and there are meteor showers where you can just lie out and just sit and look up in the sky and watch them come in. So part of the problem is getting people to understand that astronomy is that simple. But what you want to get out of it, if you want to know about black holes, if you want to know about how these other planets form, if you want to know why asteroids are a threat to the Earth, there is another layer of complexity to that. But mostly, it's a matter of scale and trying to show people that maybe some of the stuff they see in movies and TV, that's how they've learned this stuff. It's like, maybe not as accurate as it could be. But a lot of the stuff's very exciting and people love it. It's not hard to get people interested in astronomy. So that's a great hook for people like me to swoop in and say, oh, but look at what happens when this occurs. And it's fantastic. The public really reacts to it well.
And how has TV and the movies influenced our view of the stars and the skies above, and how have they misinformed us?
Yeah, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, I grew up watching Star Trek and Space 1999, for those of you out there of a certain age, and Lost in Space and all that stuff. And it's great. I mean, those shows are inspiring. They fed into my natural love of science and astronomy. The problem is they can feed some misconceptions. You know, when you see Han Solo and in the Millennium Falcon, and he's diving around the asteroid belt in Empire Strikes Back, that kind of gives you a perception of what an asteroid field is that's completely wrong. Asteroids aren't like that at all. So if people understand it's a movie, it's not a big deal. But one thing is that asteroid impacts are a real threat, not a huge one. I'm not lying awake at night in a cold sweat worrying about an asteroid impact that night, but it's something we need to be worried about in the long run. And when movies like Armageddon make it seem like, we'll just send up some guys who work on an oil platform and blow it up, I don't think the public takes that stuff seriously, but it has a way of working its way into the zeitgeist, into the way people see things. And it turns out that doing this stuff's hard, and it's something we need to be paying attention to.
And you mentioned the extinction of the dinosaurs.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not here because something the size of Mount Everest slammed into the Gulf of Mexico 65 million years ago, and that caused a worldwide, a global catastrophe. And it's weird. You just think, well, sure, it's a giant explosion. Of course it's going to be bad. But the more you read about it, it's amazing the layers and the depth of what this thing did. It destroyed the ozone layer. It caused global fires. It was more than just, you know, getting turned into cottage cheese by the force of the explosion. So we know that there's nothing out there like that that's going to wipe us out. But it doesn't take anything anywhere near that big to disrupt a global economy, which is as delicately balanced as ours is. So we need to be looking for these things, and we need to be thinking about how to push them out of the way if one's coming our direction.
And they're working on that, right? Satellites and other space technology in order to monitor.
Both on the ground and in space. These asteroids are orbiting the sun like the Earth does. They can be on very different orbits, very elliptical orbits or circular orbits or whatever. But they are out there and they're being lit up by the sun. So if you have telescopes, you can hopefully see them. The problem is that some of them are very small. And by small, I mean the size of a football stadium, you know, 100 yards, 200 yards across. And that's tiny when it's 20 million miles away. They're hard to see. But something that size coming in could actually cause a regional catastrophe. It came in over even, Kansas or someplace that is not as densely populated as, you know, Paris, which is always seems to get wiped out in these movies. It's always the Eiffel Tower and, you know, Statue of Liberty. One does not have to blow up over L.A. or New York to cause a lot of trouble. So we need to be looking for these things. And we are. And there are people thinking about it. But it's still something that we need to be paying more attention to. We're on sort of the cusp, the verge of knowing a lot more about these and being able to do something about it. And I'd like to see us pushed over into the right side of that.
And how do we do that? How is funding for this area of research? And how is the U.S. faring right now in terms of international competition?
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, the funding sucks. We could use a lot more money for this. NASA's budget strikes people as being a huge amount of money. It's $18 billion. $18 billion with a B. And it's like, look, folks, that is one half of 1%. You know, for every dollar that you pay in taxes, slice a penny in half, and that's what NASA gets. And they're building Hubble and sending probes to Saturn and putting rovers on Mars. They're doing amazing things for this money. But it's a finite amount of money. It's a limited budget. And if the government comes along and says, look, we're worried about asteroids, you guys have to do something about it, NASA says, with what? You know, if you're paying your mortgage and you're making just enough money to pay all your bills and your car breaks down, what do? You have to, you know, you have to sacrifice something to do that. Well, what is NASA going to sacrifice to take on this new thing? So we just need more money. And the money is out there. I know we're in an economic downturn, but Americans spend five times as much on tobacco products every year as we do on NASA. $90 billion versus 18. That's a choice. Now, they're not taxed for that. The government's not forcing them to do that. But that is a choice we're making to buy cigarettes instead of saving the planet. So, you know, it's a choice we should probably be making a little more smartly. That's my opinion.
Okay. And the title of your book, Death from the Skies, can you talk about that? And that might get some people a little bit worried hearing that.
Well, if you look at the book, you'll see it's kind of a cartoonish, you know, B-movie type of thing. And I did that on purpose. I'm fascinated by death and destruction. I think most people are. You know, what are the top-selling movies? And they tend to be disaster movies because it's fun. It's a roller coaster ride. In this case, some of these things can really happen. Everything I talk about in the book can really happen. I start with asteroid impacts, and I talk about giant solar storms, nearby stars exploding, the sun eventually dying, galaxies colliding, black holes, alien invasions, all the stuff I could think of that could wipe out life on Earth or at least hurt us. But it's all done in a way that's either kind of silly. I mean, the odds of a star blowing up and hurting us are essentially zero. There's nothing out there close enough. But it's a great hook to talk about why stars explode, and it's fun and interesting. Something like asteroid impacts has the highest odds of happening. If we do nothing, we will get hit by an asteroid. It's inevitable. Just when is the question, 1,000 years from now or whatever. But we can prevent them. So the things that can happen are things that we can prevent or at least mitigate, make better. And the things that we can't prevent at all and can totally wipe us out and are really just over-the-top, ridiculous things are things that are so low odds. It's happened once in the history of our whole planet, so you don't really have to worry about it. So the book is, I'm not going to say it's upbeat. Yes, it's a feel-good, you know, summer frolic. On the other hand, I try not to depress people. And I think when you walk away from this, you'll understand better what's going on out there. And you'll probably be less worried because you understand that the odds of these things happening are pretty low.
Okay, wonderful. And then you also have a blog called Bad Astronomy.
Yes.
And can you discuss the meaning behind that? That's another negative.
Sounding comment. God, I'm a downer, aren't I? I started that blog years ago because of misconceptions people had about astronomy. Just wanted to correct some ideas like why the moon looks big when it's rising and people say it's because the air magnifies it. And it's like, no, it's actually just an illusion. Why the sky is blue and things like that. So I called it Bad Astronomy, correcting these ideas that were bad. But it just grew and grew and grew. And now I write about mostly good astronomy. You know, I'll talk about the latest Hubble pictures, the latest discoveries on Mars and what's going on. There's also science fiction in there. I talk about Star Trek and Doctor Who and politics and all kinds of things. I just talk about whatever I want. And it's a lot of fun. It's very liberating to just say, yeah, I'm going to write about this today because it's something that interests me. And if it interests me, I can hope that it will interest other people. And it seems to be working so far.
And when you wake up in the morning, what are the first things you think about?
Coffee. Getting my dog out, my dog taken care of, my daughter out the door, the stuff that everybody else does. On the other hand, you know, I check my mail and I get news and it's like, oh, somebody has discovered a new planet orbiting another star that looks like it could be like Earth, you know, that sort of thing. And it's amazing to wake up in the morning. And I work from home and to, you know, basically wearing my PJs and sit down, plop down in front of the computer and have the entire universe delivered to me. And then I have to turn around and interpret it and deliver it to other people. And it's the best job in the world. I love it.
And would you ever travel to space if the opportunity should arise?
No.
Why not?
I made a TV show a couple of years ago called Bad Universe for Discovery Channel. And one of the things we did was I got to fly in an F-16 with the Thunderbirds. And that made me so sick. I wanted to die. And I thought, I could never, ever be in zero G for any length of time. I would do nothing but throw up everything I've ever eaten in my whole life. So I'd love to be at Mars. I'd like to stand on the moon. Don't want to have to go there. The trip, I think, would kill me.
Okay. And tonight, you're speaking tonight at for the Science Unwrapped USU series at 7 o'clock. And what can people expect and why should they attend?
I'm really excited about this. They should attend because it'll be the best talk they've ever heard in their whole lives, of course. Don't be silly. I'm going to talk about asteroid impacts. I'm going to talk about the reality of how these things work. I'm going to compare it to the Hollywood nonsense in Armageddon and Deep Impact. I'll have some clips from those movies and talk about it. And talk about the reality of what we can do should we see one that has us in its crosshairs.
And there was a recent event, and I probably will get the name wrong, a LIDARed or littered event that was just a few days ago.
The fireball over California?
That may have been it. I'm not sure, but can you?
I'm not sure which one you mean specifically, but there was the Lyrids.
Okay, I knew I got the name wrong.
LIDAR is something. It's something we use in space physics. The Lyrids are an annual meteor shower, and the Earth just is plowing through the debris field from a comet. Basically, it's like gravel flying off a truck, and the Earth plows through it, and these things burn up in our atmosphere. But they're tiny; they're like grains of sand, and you see a little shooting star. Coincidentally, at the same time, and it is a coincidence as far as I know, something much larger, something about the size of a pickup truck or an SUV, came barreling into the Earth's atmosphere and exploded over California. I first heard about it through Twitter. A friend of mine's parents were telling her about it, and she sent a note saying her folks heard a sonic boom. And it turns out this thing came into the atmosphere and exploded. It was in the morning. It woke up a lot of people. A lot of people saw it. And I heard yesterday that pieces of it have been recovered. These things can blow up in the atmosphere and then sort of rain debris down. And people have been finding pieces of this meteorite scattered over California, which is great because think about it. If you trace the path of this thing, you can actually get the orbit of it. And so we can find out what it was like when it was in space. And then we can have pictures of it and see what it was like when it was burning up. And then you can go outside and pick up pieces of it. And it's, you know, it's the universe brought down to your front yard and study them. It's fantastic.
And what do you recommend for the beginner astronomer or someone who's just interested in observing the night skies? What kind of telescope would you recommend?
That's a tough question because different telescopes are for different people. But if you're really interested in astronomy, there are tons of websites. You can go to Mind. There's one called Universe Today. It has a lot of basic stuff. Your best bet is to find a local astronomy club. There are astronomy groups here at the university and here in Logan and all over Utah. And go out and observe. Go to these star parties. Look up. And it's one of the best and most satisfying and wonderful hobbies you can participate in.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We're unfortunately out of time, Dr. Plate, but this was really fun. And we hope you'll come back.
Thank you.
Dr. Plate is speaking tonight at 7 in the Emmert Auditorium, room 130. The event is free and open to the public. All ages are welcome. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from S.E. Needham Jewelers in historic downtown Logan since 1896, specializing in diamond engagement rings and custom jewelry design, middle of the block at the sign of the clock. Information at seneedham.com.